ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Red Eyes Radio. I hope you had a good weekend. The website is redeyescreations.com. I'm Henrik, and today we are going to continue where we left off Friday last week and speak more about sex, gender relations, fertility, and also where marriage is heading in the world of undying liberalism. Our guest is Dr. Anthony McCarthy from England. He is the Education and Publications Manager for the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children and a visiting lecturer in moral philosophy at the International Theological Institute in Trumau, Austria. Dr. McCarthy studied philosophy at the University College London and King's College London and has a particular interest in moral philosophy and bioethics. His philosophy thesis, Ethical Sex, Sexual Choices, and Their Nature and Meaning, Perspectives from Natural Law and Marriage, was awarded by the University of Surrey and is being prepared for publication as a book. Hi, Anthony. Welcome, and thank you for speaking with us today. It's good to have you here.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Now, tell us a little bit about your background here before we get started. I guess what you think our audience should, know about you before we start talking more about your work here.
Yeah, well, I was born, brought up in England, and I still live in London. My academic background is philosophy, and particularly moral philosophy, and my doctorate, my later work, is in sexual ethics, which is, interestingly, quite a neglected area, at least in the Western world, in the area of philosophy. So I think there's a lot of writing about sex, but there's not much philosophical writing about sex. And I thought it was interesting why that should be and whether we could try and say some sensible things about it. I've been involved in the pro-life movement for a number of years. So I work for an organization, SPUC, which was one of the first organizations protesting abortion, because England was one of the earliest countries to legalize abortion. But my general work covers sort of marriage, family, sexual ethics, and, you know, some writing on, I suppose, slightly more political philosophy areas. I became interested in writing a bit about sterilization of mentally disabled people and what governments were up to. So that's basically my background. I worked for an organization that did work with the Catholic Church a number of years ago. The present organization I'm with is secular. And I've done a fair amount of TV over here, BBC debates, and found that my positions are not very popular. But, right. You would know all about that.
Well, we like to talk about issues that are kind of pushed to the fringes to a certain extent, and that doesn't mean that they're not important. It's actually quite the opposite, in my view. It's just that our current, our current climate is such that it's very, very rigid and politically correct and everything else. So these are all that you mentioned pretty much are neglected areas. Where did you study some of this, by the way?
I studied my undergraduate philosophy at a place called University College London.
Right, yeah.
And then I studied later at King's College London, which was down the road, which was a rival university. And then I finally did my doctorate at a place called Surrey, University of Surrey. And that was the thing in sexual ethics. And that was all philosophy.
Right, and you've written a little bit on this already, of course. I think you had a paper out, but you have an upcoming book on ethical sex,
yeah,
as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have a book called Ethical Sex. Coming out. It's quite a philosophical book. I mean, parts of it are quite dry, but I was told if I called it Unethical Sex, it would sell a lot more.
Right.
In fact, just to say something about that, hopefully that book will come out in the next few months. It's an attempt, again, it's not a religious book, it's an attempt to find common ground, I suppose, between people's perceptions. And it begins with a discussion of rape and the question as to why rape is such a big deal. And it asks the question, really, if you have a modern liberal view of sex, it's quite hard to account for the importance given to the subject of rape, because if sex isn't really such an important thing, why is rape such a big deal? That's how the book begins.
Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting thought, considering how, as you said, the sex have been kind of, it's been turned into something else. It's become less and less sacred in our modern Western society. What view of sex do you think we have in the West right now, and how has this transformed over time?
Well, I think there's the view of the establishment, or the presumptions, and the view of certain academics, and as so often, I think that that's somewhat in conflict with the views of most people. However, I think it's certainly got to be the case that the views that people have about sex nowadays are incredibly different from they have been from pretty much all of recorded history for the vast majority of the globe. And I think people are liable to forget this. So, for instance, we have gay marriage in America now. I mean, for all of recorded history, and even now, the vast majority of the globe would regard this as absolutely insane. I mean, unthinkable. In fact, it was unthinkable even amongst, you know, gay rights activists until very recently. So the view that we have now, I think we need to admit, at least the standard liberal view, let's say, and the view many people pick up, is a very, very strange one in terms of human history. It's, you know, you go through almost any culture, sex, there are differences, of course, but sex is not regarded in this way. Marriage certainly was never regarded in the way it now appears to be regarded.
Right.
One way, there's a philosopher called Peter Singer who's sort of infamous in some areas. He's an Australian, and he's famous for saying, justifying infanticide. So he says that, you know, total, sort of extreme utilitarian. You know, if a baby, you know, is, if it's not sort of speaking fluently or this or that and the other, it has no more rights than an animal. In fact, his other writing suggests animals have more rights, but that's another question.
Right.
But he says that sex is not in any way special. Morality has nothing interesting to say about sex, or rather it's not a fit subject. It's no different from driving a car. So the thought is, you drive a car, and there are some very basic general moral rules about driving a car, like don't pull out too early, or indicate, or drive on the left-hand side of the road, or whatever. And that's it. There's no special moral area. You don't have kind of specialists in, you know, car driving morality. And he says sex is like that. There's nothing interesting or special about sex, any more than driving a car. So there are just some basic rules, you know, don't do it without consent would be the obvious one. But other than that, that's it. So the only sensible thing you can ask about sex, according to him, is it consensual or not? You can't say, is sodomy morally problematic, or, you know, a whole range of other things that suggest that, you know, the sexual act itself is important, or questions about marriage, etc. Simply, it's just consent. And that is all there is to sexual morality. Now, that's a view, I think, that's become increasingly popular with many people. But I don't actually think many people deep down believe it. I don't know what you think, but...
Right. No, I don't know how you can have such a view when it's proven how what a powerful tool sex can be in other situations, for marketing purposes, just that alone, that it's somehow... does not hold a special place among us, but can manipulate us so much. That's just a contradiction, right?
I think exactly. And I think it underestimates the great power of sex in people's lives.
Right.
People can... Well, it transforms people's lives, you know, in all sorts of ways. And I think what he really misses, and I think what's very interesting about sex, is that... traditionally, you know, there was some idea of sex being related to love and a special form of love, you know, involving the erotic. But that was recognized as having deep resonances, saying something about us, saying something about our interpersonal relations. And that tended to have, you know, when people fell in love, they had some sense, didn't always work, of course, but some sense of the other person being irreplaceable, lifelong, of them being involved in some kind of institution that sort of pointed forward to the next generation. So there were all these deep resonances about being bound to someone, about striving towards the next generation, something having a lifelong tinge, as it were. And to completely rub this out of the picture and say, nothing beyond you has any great importance except what you happen to choose right here, right now. That is the, I think, obviously very damaging thing for any civilization and culture. And in fact, civilizations which forget about that, you know, they end up disappearing. And I think that's the deepest right, and the reductio of this. When I was writing this book, excuse me, I'm sure your listeners are used to tough topics, but
oh, sure.
There are philosophers out there, I can cite them later, who actually say that the paradigm of sex, you may have some idea, the paradigm of sex is kind of a man and a woman committed for life, or, you know, some union, a very special union. But the paradigm of sex for this person, the meaning of sex, if you like, is masturbation. Okay, so that's the paradigm. That's what sex is. It's just a simple solitary rubbing, you know, for pleasure. And all this other stuff is kind of secondary. You know, the idea that sex is in its nature interpersonal and has some relation to love and procreation, that's all wrong, according to this view.
Right.
And sex is just, you know, the basic idea of sex is this solitary thing. Well, this is kind of, you know, extreme atomized liberalism to its absurdist degree.
Right.
And I just saw a sex education book in England now. And it actually says, I mean, it actually says in the book that the best form of sex is masturbation.
Really?
Yeah, it's incredible, because like, all the other stuff kind of involves complicated human beings, and you can get diseases. Whereas
relationships
this kind of,
and the eyes.
Yeah, exactly. So these kind of children are encouraged to be, you know, totally stunted narcissists, you know, etc. But that's cool. That's great.
Well, maybe they're paving the way for the future of sex, which is completely mechanic and robotic, maybe even in some cases. So we'll see where that goes.
I think so. Yeah, I think was there a film with Stallone? Was it a Demolition Man? They end up having sex. Sex is just you meet the woman, you go to the room, and then you put on this headset, and the woman puts it on.
Right.
And you have some kind of thing which stimulates you with images of her. And, you know, the Stallone character, I think he's from the past or something.
Right.
And he's got this, you know, wacky idea that we're bodily beings and the body kind of matters. And, you know, when we connect to each other, we do so as human beings who are embodied. The mechanical thing is denial of the body, which is, I think, all the time, you know, this is kind of the deep problem with I think, certain liberal views, which don't demand that. They want to make man rootless, you know, and the ultimate rootlessness is to deny the meaning of your body, deny your maleness and your femaleness, all that kind of thing.
Right, right. But it's a contradiction, right? Because if it wasn't important, then why would we need the kind of the hypersexualization of Western culture, as we've seen in the media and television shows and films and everything else? It's this oversaturation almost to that point.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't hold any place or isn't special in some way, what is that all about, right?
Well, I think I think part of it is probably when you try to deny that something is special, it sort of comes back at you and you can't get around it. It's reality. You know, you can keep denying it and living in this fantasy world, but at the end of the day, it's there. And the question then is, you know, what happens if you deny all this stuff? Well, you know, maybe you do just end up, you know, masturbating or, you know, just basically getting it all wrong. But obviously the damage done in the meantime, you know, by your denial of reality is going to be huge in an area where I think people generally know that there are big psychological effects. So, for instance, we're talking about, you know, sex being a special area. All these notions historically of purity and dirt, well, they relate very much to the sexual. You know, they don't generally relate to property crime or car driving even.
Right.
There are all sorts of phenomena that I think we're aware of. A classic example is the fact that you know, certain terms for masturbator are terms of abuse, you know, to say to someone else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all a bit laughable and embarrassing, you know. Well, why is it so sensitive and embarrassing? Well, because, you know, I think there's a sense that it's an area where people experience kind of things that do seem different from other areas. You know, they seem particularly sensitive. I mean, life is complicated. We have all sorts of different experiences. But this particular realm always seems to take on significance. And a culture that denies that significance, I think, can end up doing great harm. And obviously, as you say, and quite rightly, advertisers, political groups, parties, sex educators, you know, they all have a purpose. They know you can use this very powerful thing to achieve all sorts of results. I think he's called Gyorgy Lukács, who was there was a very short-lived communist regime in what was part of Austria-Hungary under Béla Kun, who was a just monster, communist. Yep. And Gyorgy Lukács, who became a famous literary critic, was this great, you know, Marxist theoretician. He became the head of the education department. And one of the first things he did, it was very short-lived, thank goodness, was introduce sex education to the schools. And it's a pretty Catholic area around there. But, I mean, Catholics, conservatives, anybody who was not, you know, going to go along with them. He was absolutely explicit. He said, you know, we want to finish off religion here, or we want to finish off any kind of morality that would condemn what we're doing. And he saw that as a tool to do it. And I think something similar goes on today. It may not be so explicit and it may be a bit more confused, but broadly speaking, that's, I think, what's going on with sex education. It certainly hasn't got anything to do with concern about children's proper development and avoiding diseases.
Right, yeah. Well, the question is what is at the root of that, because I think George Lukács and a couple of other, they were behind the Institute for Social Research that kind of laid the groundwork for the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, and, yeah, that's right.
And they obviously had a political motive here, as I said. I mean, and there's many different reasons, many different philosophies that tied in with Freud on one end, and then it's more kind of political on the other. But ultimately, the view, as I perceive it, is that something's wrong with Western culture, and that needs to be transformed, right?
Yes, I think that's right. I suppose the question is, what did they see as wrong with it, and what were they trying to do? I mean, Marcuse is quite interesting, because Freud's a strange mixture, but Freud does have this idea that you can only have civilization by repressing the sexual instinct. Some extent. I mean, so people sometimes have this idea of Freud as a libertine, but he's a much more mixed character, and he thinks homosexuality is a problem. Marcuse comes along, and he tries to be a good Marxist and a good Freudian, but he ends up saying that used to be the case, but now, you know, if we achieve some kind of socialistic vision where the state, you know, has a particular role, and there's always this idea in the background of the family withering away, we've actually got to a position now where you can just have complete libidinal gratification, and that will actually enhance society. So he goes way beyond Freud. In fact, he overturns Freud by saying, well, now we've achieved the conditions, or now we've nearly achieved the conditions. So he certainly sees, you know, sex as crucial to the achievement of his vision.
Right.
And, you know, that's what's going to do it. I mean, I think what links a lot of these groups is an attack on the family, ultimately. They destabilize the very, I would say, the fundamental cell of society. But that goes back hundreds of years to the Enlightenment, I think, ultimately. There are certain forms of liberalism that destabilize the idea of the family long before these kind of outright attacks come along. And I think it's very interesting to look at liberalism and the leading theoreticians nowadays, because they are kind of destroying the family, you know, in not quite as naked terms, but they're not as different from Marcuse as all that.
Right, yeah.
They're just sort of more respectable, wasp-looking people in American universities. But although Marcuse ended up in America, actually.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This has been a question on my mind, and I usually ask guests when we're on this topic of how they could have been so successful, for one, but also how they managed to pull it off of transforming something, which you say, if we look back in history, we've had a very traditional view on sex, and there's many reasons for that, not the least that is, of course, it's what leads to the perpetuation of the human species, therefore it holds a sacred place. It's connected with love, as you said, of course, as well. But how can you say something about how, I don't know if you studied this or not, but how it was transformed, how our view, was that gradual? Was it just because of these philosophies that it went into schools and then eventually one day that when the kids grew up, then the adult had that vision? Or how did they pull it off?
Yeah. Well, I'm not an historian. I mean, I suppose one problem I have is I tend to look at the philosophy things, but of course, people's ideas have huge effects, but lots of other things have huge effects, you know, economic conditions, you know, wars, all sorts of other things. So it's probably many effects. I mean, where I would probably tend to look would be certain views of man, so the sort of anthropological views to some extent. And I think if you go back far enough, you have a view, well, if you're going to go back massively far, you have these sort of Manichaeans and groups like that who see matter as evil, and man is sort of spirit trapped in this evil body. And in the universe, is there's a sort of, there's God, there's a sort of urge and a demiurge who are battling it out. And the thing to do is to sort of try and free your spirit from this body. So the body is evil, basically, on this view. Now, this wasn't the Christian view. Although some Christian writings, sound or sometimes interpreted that way, but it can't be the Christian view because they have a view about the incarnation, Jesus Christ, and the essential goodness of creation. But these views, like the Manichaeans, took off in certain places and led to some quite interesting things with regard to sex, because the highest level Manichaeans we're not supposed to have sex at all, because obviously that's an evil thing. You're perpetuating more of these evil bodies, entrapping spirits.
Right.
But at a level lower, you could have as much sex as you want. In fact, you could have any kind of sex at all, so long as you didn't procreate. So the real evil was to procreate for these for these people. So it's crazy. I mean, and yet look at modern England, look at modern Sweden. It's, you know, the person who can get condemned in the sexual arena is the person who is procreating. Or, you know, if someone has a big family, they're sneered at.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's shocking, you know.
Yeah.
So sex without procreation has a very long history, it might seem. Now, Christianity broadly, for all, you know, many awful things throughout history, but broadly speaking, held off against that view. But it's always there, I think. And in fact, I think you know, the Puritan and the Libertine are actually quite similar.
Right, exactly. There is a link there, isn't it? Because the kind of liberalism we're talking about today, I've always felt that it is very religious in nature. It's like an extension to that type of Puritanism of removing as much as possible. And ultimately, if we look at the atomized individual as the epitome of that, then that is kind of a religious quest, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I suppose liberalism often is thought to have sort of fairly Protestant roots, but of a fairly, you know, of a very deracinated kind. I must say, it's just, you know, this whole view is very, how can I put it, it's very unsexy. I mean, it's kind of really arid, and, I mean, they claim to be these great sexual revolutionaries, and yet, you know, it's so life denying, and so everything is planned and ultra cautious, and you know,
right, exactly,
or it can't get anywhere near, you know, love or things like that. You know, as in people being unleashed, you know. So I think it's a trick of theirs to try and make out that people who don't assign to their view are somehow, you know, anti-sex. It's the other way around. It's
Well, do you think it is that they view like commitments and things like that as a potentiality of being, you know, being enslaved? Because that, ultimately that goes back to then more traditional roles and things like this, right? That the woman might be enslaved practically by the man if she falls in love and ends up in the fascist structure of a family unit, yeah, or something like that, right?
Well, no, I'm glad you say that, because there's a book, I think it's called The Family on Trial, and it has a very good opening where he talks about modern political theory classes, and he describes this institution, imaginary institution. And it's, yeah, it involves slavery, exploitation, ignorance, you know, goodness knows what else. And then at the end of it, he says, actually, they're talking about family, like the kind of family that you or I or anybody else has been born into. That's that's this wicked institution.
Right.
You know, and that's coming from different, you know, Marxist liberals, you know, I suppose sort of extreme free market capitalists as well. Yes, I mean, The stripping out of roles is interesting, because if you have this view that man is basically a spirit, the sort of dualistic view, and that the kind of ghost in the machine, then your body doesn't really have any particular meaning or significance on its own. It's just something you drive, or it's something you know, move around in. Whereas if you think that we are our bodies, okay, that our incarnational nature is important, well, then the fact that you're a man and woman is actually really important. And actually, you know, if you're a man, that says something about how you relate to women. And you're not just a man. And you're not just some individual that's come from nowhere. You were born into a family as a son or a daughter. You know, and you will be someone, you may be someone's brother or sister. All of these things are good. All of these bonds, all of this structure we entered into, are in themselves good things. I mean, they might be fractured, but they are basically good things. Well, if you regard the body and all that maleness, femaleness as irrelevant, all of those bonds are a bit hard to see why they're so important. And the thing is, and I think it's something you've talked about on your show, but all these things that you're born into are given. You're born into various bonds that are given, that are beyond you, that you need to, you have some respect for, some awe for. Whereas on the modern liberal view, all that matters is what you choose.
Right.
It is the fact that it's your choice. So in the abortion debate, there's no idea that, well, maybe you have a responsibility to this new human being. It's just your choice. You have total dominance, and that's it. It's your whatever you choose, that's what matters. As opposed to, no, there are things matter. Things that matter are bonds, you know, our heritage, our history, all these things, these matter before I choose anything. You know, my choices are made in that context of being part of a family, being part of a wider group, being part of a country, you know. So to strip all of that out, which is what liberalism does, I think you can trace some of that back to a view about the body, indeed.
Interesting, yeah. Because it's about setting free, right? I mean, liberty, yeah. Liberate something. It's a view that somehow, either if it's being born into a body or if it's something that has to do with the structure of society around us, mm-hmm. they always want to free themselves from that. And with yeah. that, I think, comes a lot of other things. That means freedom from responsibility, freedom from all the things that we need to, for example, to sustain the body, things like this, right?
Exactly. And well, the idea that we are also dependent. I mean, the idea that we're dependent, we need families. You know, we need people that support us. You know, and you know, in everything, we are. Someone said we are dependent, rational animals. Okay.
Right.
And you know, I think it's useful to think that you know, we're born into a species. Okay, the human species. Okay, whereas a lot of people sort of don't think in terms of that. They just think, I'm a human individual, and what I'll do is I'll just, on my own, I'll make all these contracts with people, and I'll do this, that, and the other. And what's good is what I choose is good, and that's up to me. Okay, and there's no, you know, there's nothing binding me above that. Well, a friend of mine used to say, contracts are a way of not thinking about morality.
Right, right.
You know, because you've got to ask, well, what's good? What's right? What's it, and what's valuable? And what's valuable is there before you get to your contracts, you know? And, you know, you can see this everywhere, I think. In fact, if I just may quote, if I've got it here.
Sure.
The Casey versus Planned Parenthood. This was the 92 decision of the Supreme Court. of course, we had another one just the other day. And this was to do with sort of marriage and sexual legislation concerning that sex and marriage. And in the course of that judgment, they touched upon conceptions of the good life and fundamental institutions such as marriage. And they quote the liberty protected in the 14th Amendment, and it says, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state." So you have the Supreme Court there, you know, taking on this radical view, really, that, that, you know, the good life is completely up to people's decisions. There's no actual objective sense in which you can talk about what's good for human beings, what's good for society, what civilization and what isn't. Now, that kind of thinking is, you know, is actually very radical. You know, and we see, well, you see the results. I mean, now people think they can define their own gender or, you know, this kind of idea. You know, it's, so, you know, it's been around.
That's just it. It's been here for some time and it hasn't fully kind of bloomed out until now. And it's going extremely quick
right
now as well.
I don't know what age you are, but I mean, I'm just over 40, and I was speaking to an 80-year-old the other day, and I was saying, in my lifetime, and yours no doubt, it's been unbelievably quick. And I just think for these people, you know, they're reaching the end of their life. They just suddenly, everything's collapsing. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the only thing I'd say is it's maybe, you know, is that, you know, looking back and reading things, I used to know people used to sort of hark back in England to the 50s. And of course, there were bad things in the 50s, as we never end up hearing, but in many ways it was a heck of a lot better than it is now. But I think the danger sometimes of people who are concerned about these things is that they settle for too much, for too little. They sort of say, oh, if only it was like the 50s. But in fact, all this stuff was corroding everything in the 50s. You know, it's just the dam has broken while we're around.
Exactly, yeah.
But, you know, when dams break, it looks very sudden, but I imagine it's over a long time the cracks are...
Yeah, the water behind that dam has been building up for a long time, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, Sweden, I imagine, is an even more radical example. So.
Yes, it is. It's going in extremely quick there. Now, but another thing about this, though, is, I mean, if they are truly for... I mean, it's just rhetoric. I understand that they talk about freedom for everybody, individuality, all these kinds of things. But there's a need within it to also change others and prevent them from making their own choices, right? It becomes very enforceful at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, liberal neutrality is a nonsense. I mean, for a start, it doesn't allow in anybody who doesn't accept liberal neutrality. So, you know,
exactly,
And yet it's amazing how people, certainly in England, seem to just basically take it at face value. It becomes a sort of consensus because there's nothing beyond the consensus. So the person your listeners should know about is this chap, John Rawls, in America, was the big sort of godfather of liberalism. He had a very interesting opening to his book, A Theory of Justice, which I think explains a lot. His idea is, okay, so you have your notions of good or whatever, you know, and I do, and, you know, we think about, you know, the family or the nation or, you know, all these bonds and all these things that, you know, are obviously valuable. But for Rawls, what Rawls says is, well, in order to construct a just society, you have to take everybody, and you put them behind this thing called a veil of ignorance, where they forget pretty much everything they know. They also forget, they are also genderless. They have no race or color or culture or religion. All those things are stripped out, okay? So the body is stripped out, if you like.
Right.
And what they have to do from here is to imagine what kind of society they'd like so that when they step through the veil, they will have that society, and they won't know how they'll come out. They might come out as a black woman or a white man or whatever. And that's how you get a just society. So, first of all conceptions of truth really have gone. It's only about what you can get a consensus on, okay? But when you make the decision about the consensus, you mustn't take into account your sex, your race, your anything that makes you human.
Well, right? Because they don't really exist, right?
Exactly. I mean, this is a total construct. But the point is, the consensus will just end up being something where you've had to strip out all of the things that make you human, and then you just get a consensus. You know?
Yeah.
And of course, if you start making a fuss about the things that make you human, well, somehow that's not just. That's not going to fit in with any consensus. That's cheating. That's not doing it. So, of course, in the end, these people can't believe in freedom, because if you allow any, you know, genuine human factor into it, that offends against the whole system. So, people sometimes use these words too loosely, but it is a totalitarian ideology, really. I mean, it cannot tolerate any sort of challenge, really. Because its core assumptions are so unnatural and so anti-human, ultimately, you know, it is fragile. I mean, I'm quite a pessimistic person, but the more political correctness has to be imposed, the more I like to think that's a kind of sign of weakness.
Well, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And someone I know was saying that, you know, in the 60s, in various places, you didn't have to impose anything. People had already internalized it all. But now, people are, I think, being persecuted more, and that's a sign of liberalism's weakness, I hope. You know?
No, yeah, I think you're right. Exactly. Obviously, it's lashing out because it's not. It's had a pretty good go, and things are not as far ahead as they would like it to be, I think, because
yeah.
I think it's not working, because it's ultimately, it doesn't take human nature into account, just what you were talking about. It doesn't have this concept that when you come into life, you basically, you don't carry anything with you. It's a tabula rasa, right? It's a blank slate. Everything you do is just going to be imposed on you by the world. You don't have anything in your genes. You don't have anything in your upbringing or carry anything with you. And that is not going to make it operate correctly in the world, a philosophy like that.
No, I think that's right. I think it's, it is ultimately anti-human. It's partly... Well, in England, in the Enlightenment, you had this big thing that there are facts, and then there are values, and there's this sort of very strict definition. You can never derive a value from a fact, and facts are these kind of scientific, objective things. And their values, things like love or aesthetic values or all these things, well, these are kind of just secondary, subjective values, probably mixed up with superstition of some kind or whatever. And of course, this is complete nonsense. You know, when I see a human being, you know, I understand that as a person who has value. Okay, not just a fact that I can say nothing about. You know, these are facts and values are completely bound up. You know, if I see a doctor, I know what a doctor does. I know what he's for. You know, I know what a wife and a husband are for. They have roles. They have beings. So they're not just sort of neutral descriptions that you give of these people, as though we then get to decide about whether they're good or not. You know, a husband's a husband. He has a particular role. He has a particular purpose. I mean, as I would say, there's a human being. To talk as though you can talk about, you know, a doctor or a husband or whatever as a role, and that's just a fact, and there's nothing you can say, good or bad, about that husband. There's no way in which you can judge whether this is a valuable husband or a doctor, is itself a superstition. And I think people, it varies from country to country, but certainly in England, that this is a very damaging idea, that there are serious facts, and that's science, usually the physical sciences, and anything else is kind of subjective. Well, that's, again, ignoring the nature of reality, ignoring the fact that things have inherent value, and they're just as real as any scientific fact.
Right. I saw recently an attack on the very idea of you know, certain philosophies and even reason in particular. The headline was, it was a professor out of Syracuse University that gave an interview to another professor being interviewed before the New York Times, and he claimed that reason itself is basically a white male construct, because it was part of this a kind of a white privilege concept, basically, that reason is something that only has been developed by European white Christian males, and therefore, you know, we have to attack that very, the very fabric of what reason is. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and he's trying to use a reasoned argument, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. But he's using an unreasonable argument just so he can suggest that it's not real, right, or doesn't work. So
yeah, but this sounds like kind of Foucault stuff that he was very big on. Everything is about power structures.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, this is deadly. I'm sure you found this. You know, you argue with someone and you think you're getting somewhere, and then, you know, then they start saying stuff about you, you know, well, you know, you're a man, or you're Swedish, or you're whatever, you know.
Right.
It's a way of short-circuiting any arguments. And it's just, I mean, first of all, they never define what power means to these people. They're just sort of, power is obviously a bad thing, as opposed to something that exists in any society and needs to be accommodated, you know, justly. But it's a very... I mean, I think people like you who are trying to sort of get consensus and do something, it's been very damaging, this kind of thing. Because, I mean, I don't quite know what's behind all of it, but it's very destructive of any kind of alliances, because immediately you split everybody up into groups,
right.
into tiny fractural groups, you know, and you set people off against each other and things like that, so that, you know, it becomes very hard to oppose... You know, injustices in the world. So, I mean, I think it's this kind of thing is a disaster for blacks in America, for example.
Right.
Because, you know, they end up, you know, sort of losing their reason, you know, following some guru, and everything is about power and oppression. And they've ceased to speak to anyone outside their group and ceased to analyze what's going on and ceased to be any good. I mean, it makes you think that these are kind of the people that spout this stuff. It's almost like they're employed by, you know, a government that wants to keep blacks down or something. I mean, it's, you know, this is what that's what I'd do if I was in this position. I wanted to keep a group down. I'd start getting them to say everything's a power structure and, you know, reason's a white male construct. And
right,
it's
right.
It's very, very depressing, but it's very widespread in the humanities as far as I can tell. Philosophy, where I was, it hadn't quite reached that level. It's kind of still regarded as a bit, you know, absurd. But it is spread very effectively everywhere else.
Right.
And I mean, Ireland is a good example. I debated gay marriage over there, and the Irish were absolutely full of it. You know, well, full of it in every sense, actually. But I mean, they were absolutely spouting this stuff nonstop. And it's all they had. They had no intellectual culture left. So
do they? Do they, well, it depends on who you ask, of course, but do they win with any of those kinds of arguments what do you call it, the court of popular opinion?
Well, they just legalized gay marriage in Ireland.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, no, well, they won in terms of the vote. I was there with these people. We were absolutely massacred by about, I mean, the vote went massively against us, but, you know, it was kind of the LGBT group and the postmodernists, you know, they're a powerful force. Ireland is a country with almost no intellectual culture at the moment, and the church has collapsed there.
Yeah.
I think the church in Ireland was very badly run for a long time. It's just now, it's just a wasteland. I mean, it's completely trashed its own history, and this is the danger if you don't have any intellectual culture. What they did is they had a lot of religious piety, and there's a lot of very good people there, but it was based on very little. So postmodernism can very quickly, you know, overturn that, and it did. I don't know. I'd be interested to know about Sweden, but I mean, it's if you don't even have that culture in place, it's going to be very hard to counter postmodernists, because all the universities are full of postmodernists, you know, this is what the children, and they're not brought up, you know, they're probably not listening to shows like this, you know, they're not brought up to think these people, you know, they think, well, these are academics, these are scholars, you know, and they look over and they think England's very progressive and forward-looking, and so a few cliches, and they're down the road. So, yeah, I mean, Ireland's a very good example of how quickly what would be thought of as a traditional culture has just collapsed.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's shocking to me, actually, because I used to go there as a boy.
What's next there? If we can talk about Ireland for a little bit more, or any other country, but what's going to fill its place? Because surely something is going to come in that holds a position or a view or something, because I think whether we admit that or not, people look for something that does hold the power and thus that exudes some kind of meaning, if you will, and people are going to be attracted to that. But the question then is, if we remove all that from Western society, what's going to come in and fill its place?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, when I'm in more optimistic mood, try and think, I'm not sure I believe it though, but you know, there is human nature, the kind of things that we're talking about, you know, I feel we have reality on our side, and that's no bad, you know, that's not a bad starting point. This thing about imposing stuff, I don't think these things can last forever, although they do enormous damage. Partly because, you know, you try and fill a child's head full of, like in sex education or whatever, all this propaganda, all this rubbish. But many children will still fall in love, and they'll still want to be with someone, you know,
right,
for their lives. And they, you know, they may want to have children, and, you know. So these sort of natural things will keep breaking out. And, I, you know, these other groups, you know, they don't reproduce themselves for a start.
Well, exactly. You know, good point. Yeah.
And I think we need to remember that. But with the Irish, my impression of the Irish is, and I grew up as a great lover of Ireland, but my father was a sort of pro-Irish nationalist and all this kind of stuff. But with Ireland, they always used to have a great dislike of the English. I mean, and, you know, very justified given what the English did in the past.
Sure.
But it was kind of, you know, it was stirred up and exaggerated by some opportunists as well. And that's kind of gone now, pretty much. I mean, there remains, but it's nothing like the same level amongst the ordinary person. That was then replaced by hatred of the Catholic Church. I think that's sort of become... Now, the situation is complicated there, because I think there were things that were pretty bad about the church in Ireland. At the same time, there are opportunists who hate the church for their own reasons and obviously want to stir up that kind of thing. I mean, gay activists would be a start, so they would bang on about the paedophilia in the church, quite rightly, you know, some which we condemn, but then they'd sort of exaggerate it. And at the same time, you know, some of their own literature would not be so anti-paedophilia. So, you know, there'd be this awful hypocrisy going on. I think that the Irish are in this stage where the, you know, trashing the church is helps form their identity in a bizarre way. But I think that's going to tail off. I think in a place like Ireland, I think it will take a very long time for them to recover from these kinds of ideas. I think at the moment they want to follow England and be prosperous. But I don't see any great hope for revival there. Countries like Germany are in a terrible state. They have more of an intellectual culture there. So I always think, I mean, just in terms of Catholic theologians and things like that, they had Ratzinger, Benedict, they had some kind of movement there, but they're in a very bad state. I just think countries that have some more of that culture are in a better position to recover when it comes to it.
Right.
The other thing is, actually, I mean, I don't know much about Sweden. I'm visiting Sweden in a couple of weeks for the first time ever, but I don't know much about Sweden, but my impression of Sweden is that it's a sort of wasteland in many ways, and yet I hear, I don't know, that people still have their sort of habits. They still admire nature. They still do various hobbies and things like that.
Sure.
Keeping those kind of things alive. You know, it's not enough, but just keeping that going is, I think, you know, something that, you know, gives you a certain readiness and an edge over certain other people. So when things are like, feel like a vacuum, at least people have got those things, which, you know, even the government hasn't ruined, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a good point. You know what? Let's us pick up and speak more about that in the second segment here. We're going to take a break in a little bit. But I wanted to ask you, obviously, I wanted to mention some of your titles. You did have the book upcoming, you said. Give us the titles there. I know you've been co-author or helped to pen another couple of books as well. So give us all the details there. And if, of course, you have a website to give out, or if you have any other presence online where people can read your work.
Yeah, sure. The upcoming book is called Ethical Sex. I don't have all the details yet, but it's, you know, hopefully it'll be coming out in the next few months. I've contributed some papers to a book called Fertility and Gender, and that's edited by somebody called Helen Watt. And there's some interesting papers in there covering some of the issues we've been talking about, including actually somebody writing on homosexual counselling, that kind of thing, which is valuable. I've also written something in another book by the same editor called Incapacity and Care. And I've written various articles over the place and given some talks. If you just type my name, Anthony McCarthy, on YouTube, maybe if you put marriage or SPUC, another one, you can get various talks. Including one at the Oxford Union, where I had a very hostile crowd on gay marriage. Yeah,
right.
So I think that's mainly. I mean, I've written some things in the past for some other of your guests, actually. I think E. Michael Jones had a
right. Yeah,
his www.culturewars.com. There's two or three articles I did there over the years. But that's that's the main. Those are the main texts. But if you just Google my name, there, I've written sort of bits and pieces to a whole range of different papers. So a couple of the things in England, the Telegraph, Mercator.com, Spiked, things like that.
Right, very good. We can have some of these links up, of course. But yeah, you're not on Twitter yet, then, so people can follow you there. So
I'm not. I'm afraid. No, I I. Yes, it's something I think it's sort of useful, but I just my heart drops when I. Now, I see people like you use it very well, but there are certain celebrities here that sort of put me off Twitter who sort of freak that they're eating a sandwich. Or
Oh, yeah. Most mundane of things there, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to give an email address, people want to learn more. My email address is A-S for sugar, D for dog, at McCarthy, that's all one word, two C's, at hotmail.com.
All right, very good. We'll have that up as well, folks. But yeah, we'll take a short break here, then we'll continue and talk more about many of the other related topics. Stay with us, folks. Stay with us, Anthony. We'll be right back with more.
Love never changes as time marches on. Love never changes. It's there with each dawn.
Once in a lifetime. It comes your way.
Deep in your heart, it is there to stay. Filled with devotion, your life is complete. Filled with emotion and memories so sweet.
Life is a song. And your dreams all come true.
This love that I feel, dear, is love that is real, dear. My love never changes for you.
Bum, 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 bum.
come true. This love that I feel, dear, is love that is real, dear. My love never changes for you. Never changes for you.
Well, dear folk, we continue as we do in the second hour with our guest, Anthony McCarthy, when we return here shortly. After the break, we have a members' website where you can hear the continuation of this program and all our previous shows. If you're not yet a member, sign up and tune in. And we'll proceed to discuss fertility, reproduction, and population numbers. We have a look at sexual education in school, promoting casual sex, what some of the consequences of this is, and also the dissolving of gender, or gender obsolescence as it's pushed in the media. We also go into transgenderism, identity politics, the hierarchy of victim classes, and much more. We also touch upon how the gay marriage thing and the discrimination laws here have forced some of the bakeries to bake wedding cakes for same-sex couples. I'm sure you've heard the stories, but the latest on this, by the way, that wasn't known by the time we did this recording, is that the Sweet Cakes Bakery in Oregon is facing a $135,000 fine. And this bakery is now forced to shut down. So we'll go deeper into this hypocrisy and double standard of using one group who is especially protected to destroy another, which is not. So much more is coming up. Stay tuned. The website again is redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up. All the information is there for you. It is quick and easy to sign up. We'll talk to you in the second hour. Thank you for listening.